Reading from Sri Bhakti Sandarbha, Anuchet 296 to 297. My devotee should lovingly decorate me with cloths, a sacred thread, ornaments, leaves, a garland, and sandalwood paste, as is proper. Srimad Bhagavatam 11:27-32. Jnananjana Salakaya Chakshurim Bhutam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manogishtam Satitam Yena Bhutale Sayam Rupa Kadamayam Dati Sapadantikam Adadanastanam Dante Idam Yache Punapuna Srimad Rupa Kadam Bhoja Yurisham Janna Janani Aragiri Bhakti Visham Priyatnai Apayam Amana Dipshamandam Kipam Griya Paraduka Dushi Sanatana Stam Rabamatsayami Mancha Kopa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhayedacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sri Vasade Gaur Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare. Greetings from Vrindavan. I have a little cold, so if I go into my 80-year-old old Indian voice, then you'll know. Very nice time of the year. A little cold at night, but sunny during the day. And always a nice group of devotees here. I'm holding class in the afternoon, and just so nice. There's always just such nice, substantial people that come to the class, a real good audience, some that have been coming every year. That's really nice. So we're on this very, very long section of Archana. And, it's not the details because it's based on the Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam doesn't give the details as much as it gives the philosophy. Although it does have a section in the 11th canto, 27th chapter, but it doesn't give the details, but the philosophy itself is very interesting. And we're discussing now the deity as where the Lord accepts his service. And it's describing all different types of receptacles in the process of archana, and not just the deity form, I should say. And then some interesting distinctions. How Lord can appear in different manifestations in the world, but he personally appears in Vishnu, as Vishnu in certain seats of worship, like the Shalagram Shila, and also discuss that when it says that deity worships for neophytes, it's meaning even for neophytes, because there's verses here that even Lord Brahma worshiped the deity. I believe in Puri, the Tota Gopinath deity, which is a deity of Krishna sitting down, would be the deity of the Lord Brahma worship, the being of the universe, or something like that, with the six Goswamis, all the temples. And so it's even for neophytes, and it's good for neophytes, but there's a higher sense of deity worship also, which helps you develop your relationship with Krishna. It's actually one of the main aspects, in one sense, of Radha Nulabhati. As Rupa Goswami says, you know, when you're cultivating and nourishing your relationship with Krishna, that practically you do two things. You hear about Krishna in a particular way, according to your particular relationship with Krishna, and you worship the particular deity of Krishna. So it's a very powerful, and what we discussed yet last week, we summed up, is he gave this verse, always from the Bhagavatam, because he established that at the topmost Purana. He gave this verse how to worship Krishna in different objects, with the idea that by maintaining a steady consciousness of his all-pervading feature, how God is manifest everywhere, you can remain in a worshipful mood in the world. And so that was describing, you know, just things like the cows and, you know, the water and the fire. And, you know, he just mentioned 11. It doesn't mean there's only 11, but there's ways to do that and remain worshipful in the Lord. Worshipful in the world, which we know is very practical because most people live in the world. They have to confront so many things, and to actually develop that type of vision is very, very helpful for one. And just the sense of seeing, you know, basically liberation means to give up the false ego. That's liberation. Personal. You can't get out of this world as long as you have the sense of ahankara, which puts you in consciousness in the center. And that's the material illusion, that you're not. So you kind of have to give that up. And specifically, I went with Jaini Dai and Seva Priya. We did a nice prikram yesterday to the Govardhan Palace there. Some more people are coming. Yeah. And Chinese came in out. Okay, wait one second. Temporary disturbance. Johnny died? Good. Good. Come in. Hare Krishna Mataji. Please come in. You're not disturbing. Just get whatever book is needed here at any time. Right? If you need some light, we can get you a flashlight here. Okay? That's what I'll do. Okay, is there anything? What book are you looking for? Oh, that's an article by Kumar Krishnamaraj. I don't know if that's a book. I don't know if it's a book. But anyway, you can look at any of his books, any look through it. All right, so I was explaining that we, you know, I took them on Pariklam. And as you can remember, that Govardhan place is better than ever. That they have 10 Sarabi cows now. They're very special cows. And then we went to Govindakund. And then we went briefly to Radhakund. When we went to Radhakund, we first approached Dameshwara. Dupal means protective directions in Vrindavan. In the east, west, north, and south is Lord Shiva situated to protect the Dham. So you have Gopishwar Mahadev. West, you have Kameshwar Mahadev. I don't know the directions. Then you have Chakreshwar Mahadev. You have Dhameshwar Mahadev. And the whole idea is that Lord Shiva is the presiding deity of the false ego. So Vrindavan means the place where Krishna is rooted in the center. And if you see any way, and everything is moving for Krishna's pleasure, if you come in with another type of consciousness, you don't actually see the Dham. You feel it, though, because it's moving against your false ego. So, anyway, that's spiritual life. You know, that's liberation. That's why that verse, Yasya Deve Parabhaktir Tata Deve, one who has implicit faith in the spiritual master, the Supreme Lord, the imports of the Vedas are revealed. Why? Because the imports of the Vedas are not apparent unless you have some type of predisposed perspective. It's like that in an elevated text. You need to have the right perspective. So if your perspective is not implicit faith, which means humility and service, you may not see that there. You'll just see all rituals. You won't get the import. That's what that verse means. That's the end. You won't understand it because you're not actually having any realization of that. And we experience that all the time in terms of Krishna consciousness. If people come with some kind of materialistic predisposition, they can't see. I don't know if this is related, but I remember when my parents came to Vrindavan in 1982. Amazing phenomenon. They weren't even messing with toilets. There wasn't bottled water. You know. So they came to there, and I took my mother to the temple. And all she could see was the chandeliers. She never saw the beauty. It's somehow, anyway, so this type of worship, but this type of worship, just seeing God's presence in the world, very, very, very helpful. And then he said there's two approaches. He analyzes verses two approaches. One is you worship the receptacle, and one is you worship the Lord itself. There's two ways to go about it. So he says, when you see the cow, when you eat the grass, you're not feeding grass to Krishna, you're feeding grass to the cow. Just like when you're cleaning the temple, you're worshiping the deity. You're not personally bathing the deity. But it's understood that it's connected. So he gave this type of approach I thought was kind of interesting. But the verse before that, before it described all the receptacles of worship, the verse before that, let it be known how to worship Krishna directly. Because Krishna comes as a human being. We're discussing Anjulila. This is the whole essence. Hare Kirtan yesterday went to Bhuri John's class on the 10th canto. We got special disposition to come. He met Bhuri John. Bhuri said, yes, why didn't you come? Of course, Bhuri John's so noble, he decided that he really wanted to study the 10th canto, but in chastity to Prabhupada, he would start with the first. So he's taught for 10 years the Bhagavatam systematically, and now he's come to the 10th canto with the full confidence of understanding in the appropriate way because of following Anugata, the Acharya, and also Le Maharaj Cricket, and really has a solid understanding. So he asked, the first thing he asked, what's the most amazing thing about Krishna? The most astounding thing about the Absolute Truth. What's the most astounding thing about the Absolute Truth? Did you know luck? What are you looking for? I believe it's an article. I'll look for it today, and if I find it, when the lights come out, all right? Okay, thank you, Hare Krishna. What was the last thing I was saying? Yeah, and the answer was that God's a little blue boy, which theologically makes sense, and that's what's going to be presented here. I see Mahamuni now scratching his head and taking notes. We can discuss that after. Let me complete the sentence. No, I'm just joking. It's theological. I may have used the wrong word, but it makes sense. In the sense, qualified. It makes sense in the sense that for service there must be need. So to reciprocate the devotee's desire for service, God appears in appropriate forms. And if you want, anyway, he appears in appropriate form, but actually, yes, so he appears in either whether it's by Kunta or Vrindavan, some human type form that responds with some need. So that's the most amazing thing. That this absolute reality has relationship with us as his energies, his jiva energies, and his relationship, and therefore, due to our desire to serve out of love, he actually manifests the need. And so the previous verse said, those articles that are considered to be the finest in the world, as well as those that are best loved by oneself, should be offered to me. Such an offering leads to immortality, because out of love, you, God senses, has need. He develops need for beauty, for scent, and he develops need. And therefore, because that need is there, the devotee who loves him tries to make the finest things. We could put confidence that he does have that need. But ultimately, what his pleasure is love. But because that's his pleasure, that's his need. And that's how love is exchanged. It's not just you sit there and love someone. You say, I love you. Or whatever the relation is, there may be an embrace, there may be an offering. So that's there. And so anyway, there's the receptacle and then the worship of the Lord directly is there. And the verse I read today says, my devotee should lovingly decorate me with clothes. This is in that deity worship section. Not the section, isn't it? If you want to see what the Bhagavatam says about deity worship, you read chapter 27 of the 11th canto. So, my devotee should offer me clothes, a sacred thread, ornaments, leaves, a garland, and sandal, as it is proper. So, the Supreme Lord adopts a disposition exactly in accordance with the devotional temperament with which the devotees worship him, as indicated in Narada Purana. So the verse said, as is proper. And proper means according to the season and time. He so much accommodates our need that he develops the same sensitivities as we have. So what we want generally we can offer in love. It's a very subtle point. The guru of the person who translated this is considered like, there's 11 PhDs from Benares Hindu University, and he's a great scholar. And I also have another friend who's initiated by this person. Another friend, he was there for like a week, and they asked this person questions. You know, some Western followers. They asked them some questions. There was always a question. One question is, let's get the guru to say something against Hello? I need some kind of confirmation that people are still there.
Haribol.
Okay, good. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Yep. I'll mute the phone. So, no, I didn't mute. I can hear it. Okay. So, they tried to get him to criticize, right? So they asked the question, can we offer Krishna pizza? Expecting the guru to say, it never says that, you know. But the guru, what he said was, you can offer, within limits, you can offer Krishna in devotion, whatever you like best, because if you want to offer something love, you have to value it. So what's an Italian offer Krishna more? To give him a pleasure, but to give him a pasta and so a pizza. Okay, you'll see the verse says you offer your favorite article and also what Krishna enjoys. So there's a combination. And you see that's done. That's done. There's a fine line. You can't step over the line and just do Krishna wants love, and therefore out of love for him, you offer him what's best. But with the consideration, of course, to what he likes, but you can. See, love is beyond the rules. This is the whole point. And so I read another reference, Lord Nityananda, Lord Chaitanya told him to go to Bengal and he came back. So he said, love is above the rules. You can't legislate love, even from authority. Guru can't say to disciples, don't worship me, don't love you. It's like, don't be with me. So there's always a fine line between that kind of consideration. It's a very, very interesting point. You know, it's when it's a bhakti, it goes beyond. Sometimes even authority, don't see them. Of course, the highest thing is that it's focusing on the pleasure, but it's a fine mixture between that. And therefore, that answer was, when you go to a Gujarati's home, right, whether you like it or not, they're going to give you Gujarati food. Because they love it the most. And it's and it actually matter because they love it the most, they can make that the best. You go to an Italian song, you get Italian. Punjabi, you get Puturi Roti. It's like that. And I remember years ago when the Russian devotees first came out of the Soviet Union, at the time when it was only potatoes, cabbage, and carrots growing in the country, this one devotee, he was in the prison for many, many years. And he had his brother was very heavy. He had two brothers. One was a mad scientist, who sabotaged the national television presentation of the Bolshoi Ballet so that the Hare Krishna mantra came on. And then the other ones, they were in prison and they tried to break them, and they kept on putting them in the rooms with the craziest prisoners, and they would convert them. And I remember when they came, when the Russian devotees came here, we worshipped them and honored them for their austerity. The first time they came to Vrindavan, it was incredible. When they came in through Bhaktivinoda Mar, and they came into the temple, and flower petals were being thrown. And then we had a big feast for them with Bibi Govinda Maharaj cooked at the Lord Krishna Maharaj's house. And I don't know why, we put dirt on the outside, and they all stepped on the dirt, and then we get the dust in their feet. It was kind of like a real, and we ate their remnants, and then they found out. And they came to me. They said, I think that being here in Vrindavan is more dangerous than even being in the prison in Russia. He said, because in the prison in Russia, they can only kill your body. But here you can kill our Krishna consciousness by taking, you know, by worshiping them, right? And then his other brother, when he was talking to me, came over and looked at me and said, Queen Kunti was right. Let those calamities happen again and again. But then, you know, we took care of them. They developed some affection. And then they wanted to cook me and Gaurijana feast. So they cooked us potato, cabbage, and carrots. And we took their love. So this is the idea. Such a fine point. Following the heart, bhakti process. O Brahmanas, Rishikesh is captivated only by devotion, not by wealth. We duly worship with devotion, he rewards all desirable objects. Although Lord Hari is the master of the universe, and although he dispels all miseries, he is satisfied even by a simple offering of water, just as a thirsty person is delighted by cool, clean water. The Lord is free from all physical requirements, but he becomes like that when it's offered in love. It's such a profound conception that the universe, and it's reasonable because that's what everyone's looking for. Because generally what you do is what? You judge things based on your experience. And the experience here is that's what pleasure is, that's what the finest thing is. So here it says this exists in the absolute reality. And to enjoy that love and facilitate that love, the Supreme Lord develops needs. And therefore, I think I'm going to just go quickly on this. Because I think, he described that you have to worship the Lord appropriately. The rainy season, don't put them in water, and, the summer season do, and these type of things, and in the Shastras, there's so many instructions of how to worship the Lord appropriately during different times of years, etc. So it's not that love is without rules either. Just out of love, you learn the sciences. You want to please the Lord. It's not when there's Raghunuga Bhakti. When there's Raghunuga Bhakti, there's not some process of what to do and what not to do. It's spontaneous, but the spontaneity and the love also makes you want to know how to do things in the proper way. So the Shastra is there. And therefore, a lot of this is on the comment of when the Supreme Lord is in the fire, a Vishnu, you worship the fire by offering ghee. That's described, you're meditating on the Paramatma and not Krishna, because Krishna has the form and environment of a human being, or for love. He accepts that. So it says, in regard to meditation on the mantra, upon the mantra that reveals one's cherished form of the Lord, the prescription is given to also meditate on the place in which the Lord is revealed. There's a connection there. One should envision such a place as congenial in all seasons, with exquisite arrangements of form, taste, fragrance, touch, and sound, because the Lord relishes these things, and he develops a need for them. Otherwise, the whole point of meditating on one's personal Lord and his own abode will be lost. Therefore, it is concluded that in fire and other similar receptacles, one should contemplate only on the immanent feature of the Lord present within the relevant substances and earth. It's a whole kind. You meditate on the super self, the all-pervading nature of God. Okay. Now it's going to describe the offering and how a Vaishnava uses the scriptures. It's a very interesting point because he's only going to mention modifications. He's not going to deal with details here. Because this isn't basically what the Bhagavatam does. It doesn't get into the details of deity worship. It just gives the very basic, and if there's a modification for Vaishnavas, it makes the modification. So he's going to talk about modifications because sometimes there are different texts that are used that are generic. So again, we're looking at 500 years ago. Can you imagine how much deity worship was part of a householder's home? And how to change their consciousness. The deity was everything, and the deity had needs, and they cooked for the deity, and they grew their garden and their flowers, and it was really centered on the deity. So people, obviously, and they already mentioned that sometimes for conventional use, the families, they were worshiping different demigods that were conventional and you know, had a function socially, spiritually, socially. So one would follow it even if he wasn't a Vaishnava, but in a particular way, he would offer the remnants, or he would see their god within. So many things like that. So here, it's going to be very interesting. He's going to describe different mantras and how Vaishnava should use them. It's probably not something that's totally relevant to us besides the principle, but may have been 500 years ago. In the description of offering food to the Lord, given in Krishna Deepika, there is a mention of a mantra composed of the name Adi Buddha. This Krishna Deepika. The exclusive devotees of Krishna, however, use the seed mantra of Lord Krishna in its place. It's a particular day. And the beach mantra, we use it of Krishna. You know, this is it. It's Krishna devotees. And in regard to the prescription that one should meditate on the offering being infused with the effulgence emanating from the Lord's face, the same devotees visualize Krishna's face blossoming with happiness while eating. Like a description of excuse me. Hare Krishna. I may go into my very old Vaishnava voice because I don't have much voice. The exclusive devotees. So, and Krishna's eating like anyone else because he performs human form pastime. So, it's just a very practical adjustment. According to your Ishtadev, you substitute the mantras, you adjust the meditations according to the because these things with the deity were already written. So they're incorporated into the practice, which is an interesting point. In Vaishnavism, there's a general principles that are given. Bhagavad Marg, general principles of worship and devotion. And then, practically, there are other things that are incorporated, and they can be incorporated from the times by the acharyas. We even learned that deity worship itself wasn't there in Satya Yuga. What to speak of adjusting different things. And of course, this takes intelligence, this takes guidance. It's very dangerous to do things whimsically, but it's also dangerous to be rigid and impractical. Yeah. I have a personal kind of website, and discussing Santa Claus Tantra, whether we should teach our kids or not. It was kind of an interesting discussion, actually, of what can be, what is it called, acculturated? Is that the word? What? Incorporated from the environment. You know, how do you adjust it? How do you incorporate things in the environment? To what extent can you? To what extent can't you? Those types of things. But we should know, whatever the conclusion is, this has been done. And, for example, harmonium is a German instrument. So if someone wants to bring a trumpet, you can't say, wait, that's not traditional. or if you do, you have to make a better argument. You know, or if someone, you know, gives asparagus to something that doesn't grow in India, you can't say, wait, you know, Krishna doesn't eat asparagus. And then serve tomato chutney or potatoes, which also are not indigenous to India. You go to Puri, you're supposed to eat the original type of food in India. They don't have anything that goes under the ground because it was considered the mode of ignorance. Don't offer anybody a carrot or anything red because you're infusing them with passion. So, you know, it's so intelligent, you know, how to make Krishna conscious vibrant. And you can see that that's what's happening here. Although the mantra that one utters may have many different meanings, one should meditate on the meaning that is specifically related to one's goal. What you want, what is your goal? The mantra may have many, it may be generic, but you meditate on your goal. I want Krishna praying. I want, you know, a particular relationship with Krishna, etc. So just as in the eighth syllable mantra, the fourth case indicating self-surrender is not used. So he's talking to the particular mantra. Self-surrender is not in the mantra. Yet one can meditate on the principle of self-surrender in the recitation of this mantra, because that's what you're doing. That may be a mantra for not surrendering, but giving for something that's used in a particular, you know, getting something. In the case of fourth case, I don't know what that means, which surrender is not used, but you have that. Similarly, in all other processes of worship, all of it should be employed in an appropriate manner. Because not all the details are going to be given. So you see, you got to be intelligent here. So you have to understand that whatever you do should be related to your goal, should be thought of in relationship to your goal. In order to facilitate the attainment of pure devotion, it's been accepted that in all devotees there are two possible expressions of devotion, the pure and impure. It means either mixed with karma, you know, you're asking something for yourself, or anya abhilashita shunya, completely pure. So both those are there. I may stop here for questions, but I'm just going to tell you a little bit what's coming up. For those of you who are there, after this section of worship, then there's Vandanam. There's one page. There's two pages on Vandanam. Then there's Dasyam. There's 1.5 pages on Dasyam. Then there's Satyam, friendship. There's two pages. And then there's Atma Nivedanam. There's three pages. And this was like many, many pages, like 20, 30 pages. So within a month, we're going to finish the nine practices of devotional service. And then we're going to begin till the end of the book, the section on Radhanuga Bhakti. Now, a lot of people hearing this will say, well, it's way beyond me. But it's not going to talk about esoteric practices so much as it's going to talk about the principles of Radhanuga Bhakti. And it's essential for devotees to actually understand that, because real bhakti is Radhanuga Bhakti. Real bhakti is not Vaidhi Bhakti, in the sense that real bhakti means you do it with attachment and you're absorbed. Not you do it to, you don't do an activity complete a rule, your own self-benefit or whatever. It's a very, very interesting section, and it's quite philosophical. It analyzes really what is spontaneous devotion, and I think it's an essential thing to understand. Otherwise, at a particular time in your life, as you advance in Krishna consciousness, or not advance, you'll be presented with some things that will confuse you, because you won't know the tattva or science. It's a very important section, so I hope you get that in a month. Are there any questions today? Yes. You got to do it quick, because the majority of people can't hear.
You said that a person judges something either.
Yeah.
Also, sound.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it seems like according
to one experience, yeah, that will be the most.
Not that
there's
just absolutely
the most. I got to repeat your question. It may be hard, but Chinese Tai said that there shouldn't be like a most astounding thing that's absolute. It should be according to your experience the most astounding thing. Well, I think the answer is the real question Borjan asked. What is the most astounding thing according to the way people commonly perceive? I think it's implied within that. You know? Yeah. Because people can't hear you, it's not going to, the dialogue won't work. But I think the point is still valid that, you know, obviously maybe he's not covering every instance. Or maybe he's even talking to the audience. But it is a fact about God that would be very astounding to understand for someone if they actually studied the philosophy, and you know, what would be the most astounding thing. That the absolute, because there's verses like that, you know, the most astounding thing is Shastra. What is it that, you know, the supreme absolute truth is like, you know, rolling in the dust in the backyard of Nanda Maharaj or something like that. So I think he's trying to make an objective statement. But, you know, astounding obviously is subjective to people, so he's trying to make it what is the objectively the most astounding thing based on this common subjective experience and conception of God as great. At least from perhaps our tradition. But there must be much more astounding things that people believe than that, right? So obviously he's talking within the context of Gaudiya Vaishnava presentation of our philosophy, you know, which is a solid theological presentation of God as the supreme conscious being of which nothing, of which everything rests on, nothing is ultimately separate from. You know, what is the most astonishing? I guess you could say, no, it's not. It's that he's a bore, and he goes all the way. You know, I guess we can get with all things, but yeah. Okay. Anybody else have a question? We have at least 10 more minutes today. Okay, then I'm going to go on for just 5 more minutes.
Maharaj.
And then I'm going to go out today. Hey, Jeremy, thank you. Yes, I will.
I did have a question, but I wanted to wait because I've been asking a lot lately.
You can ask again. Ask your question.
Okay. You were describing the principle that people offer what's best for them according to their frame of reference, and that's natural in when you love someone. And you quoted, I don't know if you quoted Jiva Goswami or Rupa Goswami, but the principle that you offer whatever's dear, and it could mean dear to you or it could mean dear to Krishna.
Amuni, are you doing it through the computer?
No, should I just speak up a little bit?
Okay, because it seems to be a delay, so repeat it again. I can hear you, but it's kind of breaks.
Okay. So you had mentioned the principle that you offer something that's dear to you, to Krishna, because that's a sign of love, because it means something to you.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask if you think that resolves the question you had about that instance where they dressed the deities in sand.
Whoa.
Because
is that, yeah, okay.
Maybe you could argue that you offer Krishna the best of your tradition. You know, so we have different traditions, and if they're not sinful, if they're neutral, you know, if they're not sinful, maybe we could offer that to Krishna because it's dear to us in some way.
Okay, here's the question. Can I repeat it, Ramali, for my audience here?
Please.
She said, he's wondering if the principle that I mentioned, that you offer what you offer, what you can offer to Krishna with the most love is what you like best. Or it's an element of offering. Does that resolve the controversy? Because they put on my website a picture of Radha and Krishna in a Christmas outfit. And Krishna had a kind of like a Santa Claus outfit. So Ram Muni wanted to say, is that one way of resolving this idea of, you know, the traditions, you know, of acculturating, what's the word, Ram Muni? Acculturating, you know?
Sounds fine.
Is that a... What? Of adopting it. What's that?
It sounds fine to me, acculturating.
Yeah, acculturating the different aspects of the tradition. I would say, without coming to a definitive conclusion on that, because people also haven't seen, as you notice, the outfit was done very, very tastefully, you know? Practically, even though it had, like, kind of furry white and red on Radharani and Krishna, except for the hat, you know, without that, if they put a different crown, it almost could have just been an outfit that they gave to the deities.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And even in terms of the deity worship and going to the mukits and, you know, you dress Krishna, you know, they have all these relief works. It's not really the descriptions of what Krishna wears either. You know, when you go to the mukit walas and things like that, it's not exactly what Krishna wears. The devotees love, want to make the most beautiful things. So it's not exactly that they just put Krishna in like a yellow dhoti. You know, they get these beautiful outfits. So obviously, there's a very, very strong element that's authorized even by Prabhupada of you know, offering things fine and nice according to the facilities, etc. Of course, this extends it a bit, you know, because that was generally couched within, you know, a certain time frame of Krishna's appearance, basically, in one sense. You can see many things that were, you know, basically outside of that or something, but even, you know, did Krishna wear crowns, basically, and they wore peacock feather, you know. So, I definitely think, without coming to an absolute conclusion on that particular picture and what they did, it's definitely an element that it weighs strongly in that argument, you know. If it really, you know, people came from that particular culture, and that's such a particular day, you know, like, you know, Krishna's, you know, birthday, they offer birthday cakes, right? I mean, I don't read about that so much in the Krishna book, you know? Yeah. And then what kind of birthday cakes they make, and the birthday cakes that you have today. So you can't deny that's an element there in that. And you can't deny, too, that if you're in that culture that's so heavily for that, it probably evokes a lot of love for the devotee. You know, and it kind of humanizes Krishna also. You know, it's kind of, he's reciprocating, perhaps, according to the environment. You know, the devotees are in a kind of like a Christian environment, and this is the way they express love, so maybe Krishna's going to accept that, because they have that's their experience of, you know. But I would have to say also, it's a fine line, but that principle is very strongly. And when you can step over that line, it's true. The Monkey Vihari, which is the main, most popular temple in Vrindavan, 2 years ago, the next generation of pujaris, the beauties open, and Monkey Vihari is in a pair of jeans holding a cell phone. There were riots, and they had to close the temple. The people were so upset. So there's a limit with worshiping Krishna according to his needs and bringing him, you know, in a mundane sense. Okay, now that I didn't give the definitive conclusion, Mahamuni, would you like to say something else?
No, I didn't have a particular perspective. You just helped clarify.
Yeah, the outfit was definitely tastefully done, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they had a sense of we wanted to do this, but keep it within limits. Now, whether they kept it within the limits or not, you know, the standard of deity worship there is just so high. I mean, they do amazing things. In Vajradham, the deity worship there, they have, I think they have an department of 12 to 20 full-time artists that are just working on the project. And they're artists, and they're creative, and they come up with many things. One time, you know, the deity's open, and Radharani was holding a pot on her head of butter. And, you know, they were so expert with the dress. And they recreated another aham that, you know, people were shocked because it looked like, you know. So they do incredibly artistic things in that place. There's always a limit, and there's always stepping over the limit. But their deity worship standard is very, very high, it's a fact. Okay, Mooney, thank you for that question.
Just where is New Vrajadam, Maharaj?
In Hungary.
Oh, in Hungary. Okay. Thanks.
It's in Hungary.
Thank you.
It's outside of Budapest someplace.
Thank
I've
you.
Never seen it. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not just that they hire artists, because a lot of people that come to progressive movements are alternative types and artistic types. And backdrops and things are incredible, different pastimes, and yeah. But there are times I know in that temple, maybe another temple, where I forgot what it was, not that temple, but another temple trying to imitate that temple. You know, one time Krishna was dressed as, I don't know, some other avatar or something. It was like, you know, like he dresses Lord Shiva and Parvati on Shivaratri, and then, you know, there was protest and people, you know, stopped it. But, you know, it's a very interesting story in Udupi when I went. Their system is they have 8 acharyas. Each acharya every 16 years gets 2 years to worship the deity. And the other acharyas are picked according to astrology. It's practically only 8 people in their thing, like sannyas or something. And so they're general and they're learned in their thing. But somehow or other, one of the acharyas, somehow they're like so austere, you know. Like, they can only bathe in a holy river. They can only rub a cloud on the page of a swami. One of their main swamis came to Mayapur for Prabhupada's centennial. He stayed out in the hut. It's the winter. He bathed in a Ganga. They cooked on cow dung. They have such strict rules. But one of the guys is an artist. It's like, and he blows their minds. He's an artist. Somehow, this made an artistic thing. So you go into his temple. He has a whole section of big aquariums with exotic fish. Like huge white fish. And my assistant, when I went to Udupi from this Sanskrit school, he's from that area, and he tells me the whole history, how this guy just was not like a scholar like the others. But I said, what's this about? You know, he said, it's matcha. You know? So then, when he has his time, every day, the deities are dressed in different incarnations. Because it's Udupi Krishna, and this guy does incredible stuff. So it's a discussion there what to do about this guy, whether he steps over the line or not. But, so there's always a fine line, and that's the point we talked about, realization. You know, people without realization to do one of two things. Keep it in the original package, even though it can no longer be marketed. Or they market the product of Krishna consciousness, change the package, and lose the product. Somehow they repackaged it in a way that you lose the product. So it's always that fine line, you know. So let's say with the Christmas outfit, you know, is it, you know, dynamic, you know, changing the form a little bit to accommodate the culture and inspire, you know, the devotees in Krishna consciousness, which, you know, you can have someone who's strict, traditional, and the whole community board. You know, it's so strict and traditional that the whole community's fried out. You know, they want to wash their hands and, like, you know, like a little point will be, you know, a little point will be magnified in the way that, like, I remember in the book of Temple once, it's a great kirtan leader, and he grew a mustache. And they wouldn't allow him to eat the top. You know, so he was the best kirtan leader. They wouldn't allow him to eat kirtan. But, no. They wouldn't let him eat kirtan. He was wearing a mustache. You know, so that's kind of like, you know, you have that kind of mentality. You know, become, you don't accommodate the environment, you know. People are working outside, and, you know. And then the other thing is that you put everybody in rows and get a church organ, you know, and try to reach the outside people and lose the the depth and richness of the Gaudiya culture. Okay, thanks, Moody. Anybody else?
Maharaj?
Yes, Hare Krishna.
Please accept my humble obeisances. All glory to
Jaya.
This is Bhakti and Stella.
Hare Krishna, Stella.
Hare Krishna. I just, when you said, like, you know, bring out the robes and everything and lose the Vedic culture, this coming Sunday I was asked to spend 15 minutes chanting the Maha Mantra at a Unitarian church during their service.
Wow.
And I was asked to, you know, could I come in devotional clothing, and I'm going to wear tilak and do the whole thing.
Right.
So, yeah, I just, you know, just that combination of Christian and Vaishnava, that I just thought that was a nice example.
I want to tell Jagni Thai, because he's here. Stella's going to Unitarian Church, where she's going to chant the Maha Mantra for 10 minutes, and then she gets to dress in a sari. But I said, that would be the case if they said, please wear traditional clothes. You know, you would go, because obviously you're spreading the holy name. Yeah, I already wrote you about it. I mean, I really like Carl's...
Oh, yes.
Very informative article. Thank you. Thank you, Stella. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. I hope you feel better soon.
With your prayers, I will feel better. I mean, you know me, I don't go down quickly, you know, health-wise. But
right.
I'm already feeling better just by speaking. Thank you so much.
I hope you do feel better. Please take care, good care of yourself.
Thank you so much. Hare Krishna. Thank you. That's so nice. Anybody else like to say, ask something? Yeah, when I meant robes in a church organ, I meant like placing perhaps the traditional services with that, which was done and probably went too far at one place. Not that we can't utilize that in outside places and I was speaking to Yagya, and he's studying the most successful churches in New York City, and they have very, very successful churches, very successful churches. And he gave me a link. That guy's name is Tim Keller. I looked at his website, brilliant preacher. And you know, they all have music. We got to look at the success, and they have music that does incorporate modern culture, just like you do with the harmonium. So, you know, so they, and it's all Christian spirituals, but it's very successful. It's usually successful, like, you know. He has, you know, they have a church, but he rents out through college or CCNY, and he does things in the morning and the evening. And, you know, he was telling me, they have jazz quartet in one, they have, like, classical in another. And so I think there is scope to, you know, preach and accommodate people's needs. But at the same time, the principle probably would be there is some rag and some connection with the music and the expression of Krishna. And so it's a fine line. But already, what can we say? We have the harmonium, and it's German. We can have the trumpet. I think what I was talking about with the change is when they completely change the whole thing. You know? And probably in doing so, lost to some of the spirit of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. I'm sure appropriate changes can be made without losing the spirit. And it was just a lack of realization, and therefore it failed miserably. But it doesn't mean that people can't incorporate things appropriately. They have to preach And it doesn't mean that people can't interact and respect spiritualists of other faiths and interact with them. And it is a fact, too, that the thing that is least attractive to progressive people in America is a sense of sectarianism. So even if you think you have the best religion, the best this, the best this, the best this, you don't spread it. If you don't learn to see Krishna in others and broaden your perspective, you just won't spread it. It doesn't work. And it's something you can't fake. You can't be in that mood. You'll go outside and present something else. Because it's not such a very, very fine line how to do that. But we definitely know that Krishna consciousness is not presently being packaged appropriately to market it to people who could benefit from it in America.
Marsh?
Yes.
Something came to mind that I wanted to ask you, but if I interrupted your thought, I apologize. You reminded me of a challenge that a devotee friend of mine brought up to a certain way that things are done. And I'm not endorsing that challenge, but I want to lay it at your lotus feet and ask you what you think of it.
I got to tell you, a challenge is coming. He's giving another challenge. Yeah, from someone else, and he wants to see what you think about it. Okay, go ahead.
You had mentioned about kind of how, you know, there's a balance between tradition and innovation. And I want to ask you about the principle about who wears robes in our culture. Because when I was imagining the church, Yogya's church, you were just describing the one image. I'm sorry, one second, please. Can you please take her? Because, sorry. I was imagining, what if they all wore robes like Jesus did? Like, what if they were all trying to dress the way Jesus and the 12 disciples dressed in Manhattan? With their tunics and their sandals.
And right.
It reminded me that a friend of mine once said, this is a devotee, he said, I can't understand why people in the congregation wear dhotis. It seems to me it only works if it's what the priests and the monks wear. But for ordinary people to wear, it's like everybody walking around with priest's collars on.
Anyway, I got to repeat for the audience here that Mahamuni is question said, why does the congregation wear dhotis? It would be almost like, you know, going to a church and everyone wearing priest collars, shouldn't be reserved for the priests, at least.
And again, Marge, I'm not necessarily endorsing this, but
I understand you're bringing up a point that appears to be, these polemics. I guess that's what you called. It just forces us to actually understand the point deeper.
And I can see
my audience here, Jaini Thai and Hari Kirtan, their active brains churning. And I wish they had phones so they could actually participate. But they're sitting here having the same time.
I could hear Jaini
Thai. What?
When Jaini Thai asked his question, I could hear it, by the way.
Oh, by the way, they can hear it when you ask your question. Jaini Thai is used to being in the courtroom and making himself heard.
Put the footnote on that. I can understand now. I'm going to represent my buddy who asked me that question challenging.
I'm
his advocate now. I can understand that in the beginning of the movement, Prabhupada was creating an alternate society, and it makes sense everybody would dress kind of like in this different way. Even in times when it doesn't make that much sense to wear a dhoti like the winter, You know, okay, fine. It's like he's creating an alternate world. But as it is now, that structure is not what's pushing on the movement. The structure now is most devotees live outside. Most devotees are doing their sadhana on their own and coming to the temple once or twice a week at the most. And it's not an alternate world. It's the people who straddle both worlds. And so I wonder if someone could say that it's about as reasonable for us to dress like people, like 16th century Bengalis or something. It's about that reasonable as it would be for people in the Christian congregation to wear tunics when they go to the church.
Okay.
He's arguing.
Okay. Well, let me say one thing that I think sometimes we don't understand Prabhupada. For example, when Kirtanandi first came to India, I think Prabhupada wanted him in a suit as a respectable gentleman in a shaved head, you know? So, I don't think that what we set in stone has always been set in stone by Prabhupada. And, you know, for example, when I first went to the Watsika Temple in 1970, the same temple they had, Prabhupada kept in the church pews. And there was a piano in the front. And you heard the lecture first, and the deities were behind. They weren't things that you walk in and confront people with. You know, that was a little bit, they invited you behind after they even fed you. They even had the feast. And then they said, if anybody would like to come, we're going to have kirtan and chanting. So that's it. And I would say that I would say you have to see the principles of the dress and see when they're applied. You know, one principle of the dress would be a certain mood it gives one, practice Krishna consciousness. You know, I don't know how relevant that is for wearing it outside, but, you know, saris can be extremely attractive and beautiful. That's another thing. You know, I think so I don't know what the principle is. Hare Kirtan? Come closer and you'll speak loud and everyone will hear.
First of all, yes, from the standpoint that you would follow Prabhupada's original vision, Mahamuni, you are correct. Because my understanding is that Prabhupada wanted us to be respectable looking Western dressed boys and girls wearing tilak and men's face having shaved heads. And that was his original vision. He didn't ask anybody start wearing dhoti, but they just started doing it. Prabhupada acquiesced to it. The second point is that when we wear dhoti and saris, particularly Westerners, wearing dhoti and saris in public, it creates teaching opportunities. I was on a train to London once, so I had to go to the temple, and someone on the train said, why are you dressed like that? And I replied, so you would ask me, why I'm dressed like that? And I continued to explain to them what, you know, who I was and why I was, and et cetera, et cetera. And the third point is that even when you go to the temple, you don't actually dress like the priest, particularly when it's 40 degrees in the temple room.
Interesting perspective. It's a fact that I think that's definitely a fact in it. That, and I guess maybe as more people came, maybe Prabhupada got more confidence that he'd actually created an alternative culture. And obviously, in the hippie days, you could say it was even weird looking going to the Second Avenue. But it is a fact. And I know for myself, now I'm, you know, late 50s, and when I walk in robes, you know, and with the beard, people open doors, they're respectful, you know, so there's a certain thing in the culture today that is actually respected. But what really disturbs me is when I'm doing a little program someplace. I used to do one in Northampton by the Kripalu Institute in one devotee's house, and, you know, and people would come. You know, so there would only be a few people coming, so you wouldn't want them to feel intimidated. So it was actually better if the devotees who wanted to come didn't wear dhotis. It would make people feel more at home. It would facilitate the preaching. So let's have five or six people in there and then seven already show up in dhotis. It would look so much better if they wore clothes. It would facilitate the preaching. And particularly one person used to come with dreadlocks. And then he used to go and put on his dhoti for the program. You know? And I always would think, why? So I think, again, I don't know, utility is the principle, you know, it's got to be a fine line, you know, and I would say for the preaching in the West, if we have functions where outside people go, it's much more effective for the preaching if people dress like the people outside so that they won't feel like, intimidate, you know, you're putting up a barrier that if you want to join this movement, you have to change your whole culture. Where people are, they want transformation of consciousness. And if we're going to present that in the thing where you got to change your whole culture, it's going to, you know, be a little difficult. And then it depends where, you know, in like Kasuba, he's in that yoga studio. You know, he wears a dhoti. And people think he's just an elevated soul, you know. It works in that way. Anyway, very interesting.
All right.
Yeah.
So thank you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate Hari Kirtan's point about, you know, it does create preaching opportunities. It really struck me what you just said about how one thing it does in our modern way of doing it is it can create barriers to people because they think, wow, I have to radically change everything if I'm going to be like you.
Yeah, yeah.
And the funny thing to me is when I used to wear a dhoti to school for a couple of years, I would only wear a dhoti when I went to school. When I'd come home, I'd put on sweatpants.
Mahmoudi said you should go to school and wear a dhoti, right? And he said, home dress with pants. He was a complete immigrant. I'll tell you one other story, Mahmoudi, right?
Okay.
You know, from our Krishna Maharaj, he thought of everything very carefully. So when he went to the university, he decided that he would go, right, as, you know, a representative of Vaishnava monk, right? Which he was, inside and outside. And, you know, he thought so carefully it was really the appropriate thing to do. And he became respected in that. And he was so clean and high class in every way that, you know, it really worked. But then he said, I mean, it's an example. He said, Rebbe Mandelbrot told the story that he went to college. You know, he had a different mood. So he went to college in pants. And then one day he invited a distinguished professor over, right? And the professor opened the door. He was in his robes. He never told the professor. And when the professor saw his robes, he just looked. And we got on and said he lost all potency that he needed to preach. He said he lost all potency to preach. So, you know, one time, as we're getting into this bhav here, because it's New York, Kunshiki Shore was a secretary, an advertising firm on Third Avenue. It's New York, so they invited me to come on the dress down day. A Friday afternoon, a Friday, you could wear whatever you want, you know, they had a dress code. Because it was New York, it was great. Every room I went to, they were greeting me. The flowers, it was amazing. One old guy came in with a banana and said, here, have some dasada. I thought, we want these. It was a computer printout. When I got down the hall, computer printout saying, welcome, Hare Krishna, you know, to New York. But when I finally got to, like, her main desk, everyone was at the office surrounding me, you know, and they asked me why I dressed like I did. But because I guess I was a priest, it was more appropriate. I said, it's a uniform. And then it got like kind of like that. And I said, there's two purposes of a uniform. One, it creates a particular mood, and you're able to be identified. So as a priest, it's very appropriate. I said, just like a policeman has a uniform for that reason. I said, we can also make the arrest in plain clothes. Okay. Well, okay. And now, would anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hi, Bo.
Hare Krishna, this is Dr. Carl.
Carl, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Bo. I wonder really so much. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
No, what are you saying?
If I could add one more one more thought about devotional cloth. And
yes, please.
Tamal Krishna Goswami in Cambridge, he was really particular about that, as you say. And when devotees would visit him there, he was also very careful about how they should dress. And his standard was how they would represent the cloth. And that if someone, you know, sort of the devotees would come there and sort of, you know, behave in a way that would be respected by the community and increase the community's esteem for devotees and attraction to Krishna consciousness, then he wanted them to wear devotional clothing. But for most, just not being sure how it would affect his standing at the university and also people's thoughts, he had often devotees would dress in, you know, in street clothes. But when we were there, we also asked him, you know, like asked how he would prefer that we dress. And his question in response to that was, well, how do you, what makes you feel more Krishna conscious? And
wow, huh?
Yeah, that, I mean, and that it led to a whole discussion. And I saw that, you know, many of us actually have a, I think, you know, I have a hard time just being Krishna conscious and feeling Krishna conscious. And so sometimes, you know, wearing a dhoti to, whether it's the temple or outside or going to temple, one feels perhaps more self-conscious about one's Krishna consciousness. And can help someone, it has helped me feel more Krishna conscious. So just that has been another benefit of that.
Wow, that's wonderful. I'll share it with your friend Johnny Tai here. No, that's very wonderful because it seems that nothing is good or bad. It depends on its utility.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's Tamal Krishna, who's expert, even this, he knew how to utilize things. And I think knowing him, he took all the factors involved. You know, how does it attack the outside community? How does it attack the individual? What's the particular circumstance involved? You know, and wonderful. Thank you, Carl.
Thank you very much, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna? Okay, we will say goodbye now from Vrindavan. Panchakopa, the biggest chakra person to be, the shop, the temple.